This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, we have had a strange winter, a long winter and a wet winter. And the climate has been strange for most of the time, not just here, but elsewhere as well. But what is undoubtedly one of the biggest factors in our existence as human beings is global warming and its consequences, most severely felt, I would think, in Africa and other places, but also being felt here. And it's a pleasure to welcome to the stand John Gibbons, who's a campaigning journalist on climate and the environment for a very long time. He has been writing now about some of the causes and what we are doing and what we are not doing. John, thank you very much for joining us on the stand. As recently as an hour ago, the Scottish Government, which under Nicola Sturgeon had done very well and been very ambitious on climate change, has announced it's not going to be able to sustain that, and they're drawing back from some of the commitments she gave. She's no longer in government, obviously. What are we doing in Ireland, and what have we witnessed this winter in terms of floods, in terms of devastation of farmers who can't even get a tractor into the field?
Hello, Eamon, and delighted to be back on the podcast. Yeah, I think if I can go back maybe to 2023, it was an absolutely incredible year globally. Reckoned probably to be certainly the hottest year in the instrumental record, but scientists reckon that it's probably the hottest year Earth has experienced in about 125,000 years. Really incredible year. Vast amount of energy in the global system, and it played itself out on pretty much on every continent on Earth with extreme weather events, extreme precipitation events, extreme flooding, wildfires, droughts, desertification, and so on. So it's a sort of a biblical scenario, Eamon, that played out in 2023, and it, of course, it hasn't relented. And what's really important to understand about the whole, I guess, climate and global warming thing is, this is a very much a cumulative issue. Every year, we're adding roughly 50,000 million tons or 50 billion tons of heat-trapping gases. These are long-acting heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. So the gases that we released 30 years ago are heating the atmosphere today. The gases that we release today will continue to be active in 100 years' time. So it's a ratcheting of a crisis. That's the best way I can put it. And essentially, and in simple terms, every year is getting worse. Now, it isn't getting evenly worse. It bumps along because of weather variability. But we can say essentially that we're on a ratchet that is taking us quite quickly towards very, very bad outcomes.
Now, sea surface temperatures are at record highs. And as I understand it, February 2024 was the hottest on record. Global temperatures have reached record seasonal highs. And in 2024, the question is, are we going to see the first full year which breaches the 1.5% of warming? Can you explain what that is? There are targets, John, and it looks like we're not meeting them, but nobody else is either.
That's right. Obviously, and it is important to say, anything. This is a global crisis. While individual countries, what we do at a government level, at a European level is important, it is a global crisis and has to be viewed in that context. So the target that you refer to goes back to the Paris Agreement in 2015. And that's where the nations of the world came together to agree that we had to limit global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial, right?
Was that by 2030?
Well, that's forever, basically. Right. I see the thing about these limits, Eamon, is they're basically, these are the limits not of politics, but of physics. What we know is that beyond 1.5, and particularly beyond 2 degrees, essentially Earth systems begin to break down, right, in all kinds of catastrophic ways. Now, I've just described 2023. That is a taster of what happens once you push Earth systems out of the stable pattern that they've been in for, by the way, for about 10, 11,000 years. We've enjoyed, like on a global level, incredibly stable climatic conditions since the end of the last ice age. And those conditions basically are coming to a rapid end. And we're moving into what's called a super interglacial, which basically means we're heading into a hothouse Earth period. And the issue here really is, this has happened, by the way. Some of your listeners say, but hang on, this has happened in the past. They're absolutely right. But no human has ever existed during a hothouse Earth period. So you're talking about phases in Earth history that are completely incompatible, especially with complex human civilizations. So the civilization and the climatic conditions to which this version of human civilization has developed and has thrived in, that's the one we need to be hanging on to. There's no point in saying we'll adapt to a different climatic era, because in all likelihood, that'll be impossible. One of the first things to go when you have a climate shift, and this, by the way, Eamon, is in either direction. If you had a glacial or a mini ice age, that's equally catastrophic. So I'm just saying any shift in either direction is seriously catastrophic. And the first thing to go are the global food systems. And we're seeing that already right now. You referred to the hardship that Irish farmers were already experiencing, but that is just a light foretaste of how hard the global food production system is already being battered by extreme weather events. We saw, for example, in 2023, large tracts of southern Europe, and I'm talking about in a belt running from Greece through Italy, across the Iberian Peninsula, down into Morocco, and so on. These are the fruit basket and the vegetable basket for Europe. Yes. Many of these areas saw huge drops in productivity. Crops that are traditionally heat tolerant, like olives. We even saw olive production falling sharply across Europe. So what that means, Eamon, is many of our crops are moving towards the threshold and beyond the threshold of their tolerance. And beyond a certain point, they simply don't grow anymore. And also we're experiencing, with the type of heat in the system, we're seeing evaporation, which is leaving parched earth, which again is disastrous for farming. So farming requires stable, predictable weather, sunshine, obviously, when you need it, a certain amount of rainfall, but everything in moderation. That's a thriving agricultural system. But when you throw that into chaos, when you get months, weeks and months of drought, followed by catastrophic downpours, that's a combination, really, for food shortages. And it's a personal, certainly, concern of mine that I think Ireland is particularly badly prepared, Eamon, for a future in which food shortages are going to be the thing that we worry about far more than whatever is going on in Dáil Éireann. What people are worried about is food.
Yeah, so let me ask you about the farmers in rural Ireland in particular, where they are resisting government calls for change, environmentalists' calls for change. They're pointing to elsewhere. They're pointing to the really major polluters in the world, in the United States, for example, China, for example. And they're questioning the speed at which our own government wants to do it. Have they got a point when you take this other fact into account? The people buying SUVs, these big cars that have massive emissions, apparently in Ireland, we're buying more of them than anywhere else in Europe. Aren't the existence of cars like that, the popularity of them, can we blindly be driving them around and at the same time asking farmers to make sacrifices on our behalf?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting way of putting it. The way I would break it down is that every sector has got an impact and every sector has emissions attached to it. You've just described the transport sector, which is a huge problem. But in Ireland, for example, our number one polluting sector by a large distance is in fact agriculture. It's almost 40% of our total national emissions, which is really strange considering that the agricultural sector accounts for maybe in total, and I include agri-food manufacturing sector, maybe 6% of our population. So it's overrepresented. So that isn't inevitable, by the way. Of course, we need food production, and of course, food has to be produced somewhere. The issue really is that, unfortunately, we've gone down a model of food production in Ireland that is particularly emissions intensive, that is particularly pollution intensive, and is particularly hard on biodiversity. They are political decisions, Eamon, that have been made. We're extremely exposed in Ireland. For example, we're importing, I did a quick calculation on this the other day. Every year on average, we're importing about 5 million tons of animal feed, about 5 million tons. Now, that works out at about 100,000 tons a week. So if you break that down into a working day, we've got about 20,000 tons of animal feed being imported from distant markets into Ireland every day. Now, that works out at the equivalent of about, about maybe 1,000 truckloads of food coming in to Ireland just to support and maintain our animal agriculture base. So I would argue that that is unsustainable. And it also, Eamon, puts us in a very vulnerable position when those supply lines become strained, when we're unable to get access to that imported food.
And what about people who can afford to and like to and prefer to, in fact, drive SUVs? I mean, they're everywhere, they're ubiquitous, and they're very nice to look at and probably safer than the average car. I don't know about that. But they're pretty deadly environmentally. Now, tell us this, John. Does sort of the emissions of SUVs count for very much compared to the stats you just gave us about farmers?
Well, okay, let's start with, say, transport emissions in Ireland. They account for a little less than a fifth of our total emissions, which, by the way, is pretty huge as well, right? So it is huge. It's obviously a lot less than our food sector, but it's our second probably most important sector. And I completely agree with you, by the way. We've taken to SUVs like the proverbial duck to water in Ireland. We've very much followed the American model of upselling. And by the way, this is very much driven by the industry. Blaming individuals for it. If you go into a car showroom now, you're presented with a range of SUVs. So they've taken away choices. Manufacturers have discontinued popular saloons because the key thing here is SUVs allow bigger profit margins for car companies. That's why they're driving it. Now, SUVs present, as you say, they've increased the emissions from the transport sector at the very time we needed to get those emissions down. And we know, for example, that all the gains, all the environmental gains of electrifying cars, of plug-in hybrids, all of those have been wiped out by the increase in the frequency and the number of SUVs on the road. So basically, we've made almost no progress in reducing transport emissions because of the rise of SUVs. That's the first point I'd make. The second point is SUVs, if you drive one and you are unfortunate enough to be in a collision, especially with a child, you're far more likely to kill that person. That's just a simple statistical fact. So therefore, if you drive an SUV the same way as you drive a regular car at the same speed and you're unfortunate enough to be in a collision, you're presenting a greater risk to other road users. If you in an SUV strike a regular car, they're more likely to be killed by you. But ironically, Eamon, despite this, SUVs themselves are not particularly safe. Because of their high seating position and their high center of gravity, they roll quite frequently in crashes. And as a result, you're no safer in an SUV, even though you've made other people more unsafe, you personally are no safer in an SUV, or your children are no safer in an SUV than they would be in a regular car, but they do present huge risks. And the other thing, of course, that we see with SUVs, our cities are basically designed on medieval templates. The roads were designed for horses and carts from many centuries ago. And the SUVs are getting wider, by the way. This isn't just your imagination. These vehicles are actually getting wider. I think a statistic I read recently is that they're increasing in width by 1 centimeter every 2 years. There's like an arms race between the manufacturers to make bigger and bigger and bigger models. And many times they don't fit into car parks. If you try to park in your shopping center and you've one of these beside you, you notice that its wheels are pushing into yours. And this, you know, we haven't introduced any regulations on this. Other countries like France, for example, are now piling on the taxes onto SUVs to try to limit this. But so far, no steps like that have been made in Ireland.
Well, let me ask you about electric cars. There was this idea around for several years that they were the future, and that everyone would be driving them eventually. Now, we learn that electric cars are becoming very unpopular, the sales are down, and that's everywhere around the world. Now, I know you drive an electric car, John, because I've met you in it and examined it, investigated. But the serious point is they're becoming less and less popular. We haven't built the infrastructure, have we, to facilitate people driving electric cars, if you want to drive to Cork or Mayo or wherever. What's going on there?
Sure. The first thing I would say, Eamon, is that I think it's like any new technology. There's the rush with the early adopters. I'd include myself in that. So there was a rush and a lot of excitement and so on about electric cars. Now, however, there's now a backlash. And the backlash is coming in the form, for example, of unhappiness about the access to chargers. There's also been quite an interesting backlash about people concerned about the drop in secondhand values because, for example, if you bought your EV maybe 2 years ago and it's replaced with a more modern model, you may have experienced a loss in that. Now, that's because we're in a new technology here. If you like, the combustion engine dominated motoring for more than a century. So this is the first sort of phase shift in motoring in literally since 1900, effectively. And therefore, it's probably to be expected that there's going to be, challenges and difficulties in that, and uncertainties where nobody's quite sure how it pans out. I would totally agree with you, by the way, that we've been very poorly served, particularly in the rolling out of the charging network that should have been available to support this. I would personally lay much of the blame of that at the foot of the ESB and ESB networks. This is a 96% state-owned company, but they don't seem to be interested, which I find pretty incredible. So I think there's been a massive failure on the part of the ESB to grasp this, and you might say by their political masters to make them do this. But I just think it's an incredible missed opportunity by ESB to be part of the electrification of our motor fleet. How they can't see that as a massive commercial opportunity for an electrical company, I will never understand. But I've looked at stats the other day that show that Ireland is falling well behind European averages in terms of our rollout of a high-quality charging network. Many of the chargers, Eamon, that are out there are rubbish. They're like 22 kilowatts, even 50 kilowatts. They're too slow, right? What you need are 125, 250 kilowatt chargers that allow somebody to pull in, have a quick cup of coffee, and have their car fully charged and be on their way. Now, right across Europe, we're seeing that network. For example, the car that I drive has its own network, and all of the charging starts at 125, rises to 250. I have driven that car around Ireland, Scotland, France, Spain, using that car's company's own network. Right. Never a problem. Rapid charging, Eamon. And it makes it so much less tense when you know that you can count that when you pull in, you're going to get a quick charge, and also that there are plenty of chargers and they're well maintained. The network in Ireland, I'm sorry to say, is shambolic. We have numerous private companies, each doing their own thing. You pull into one that says, oh, you need to register, download our app, register your credit card. This is ridiculous. If you went in to buy a liter or a tank of petrol, you're not asked to buy an app. You just buy the petrol. So it should be as easy and as transparent as that. But for some reason, we at the moment, we have a bit of a mess. But I will say, Eamon, if I might, that I'm 6 years now as an EV driver, and the experience is excellent overall. I'm lucky enough to have off-street parking, which does solve one of the issues that many people have. So I'm able to charge at home overnight using super cheap electricity, about 10 or 12 cent a kilowatt hour overnight. So it's fantastic. It means that the car is ready to go when I need it in the morning. I can hop in the morning here if I want and drive to Cork. Now, I'd probably take the train, but if I had to, I can drive to Cork in that car, no problem, right? Now, I don't drive at 120, by the way, on the motorway. I've got into the habit of maybe slowing that down to 110, and you notice a huge increase in your range when you do that.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, let me ask you a bigger question, John, and it is about militarism, war. And we are living now in a world where there are effectively, well, the Ukraine and Russia is a war, first European war for a long time. And what's happening in the Middle East also might be categorized. And all across the world, there are military conflicts. These weapons and these conflicts, they increase the total carbon emissions in a very big way, don't they?
That's right. I mean, warfare and militarism, I guess it works on a number of levels. Number one, as you said, there's the direct carbon impact of militaries. For example, keeping a fighter jet aircraft in the air for an hour uses thousands of liters of aviation fuel. So they're fantastically inefficient. Powering major ships, these are enormous things. So the actual, carbon footprint of the global military, especially the big ones like the US, like Russia, is huge. The second aspect, of course, is the damage done by military. We know, for example, studies have already been done, or at least preliminary studies, at the ecological devastation that has been occurred in parts of Ukraine and right across Gaza. This is the severe contamination and destruction of farmland and of other resources, like, for example, the Israelis, among other things, targeted solar panels, if you don't mind, to make sure that to maximize their destructive impact in the region. But Israel essentially has engaged in the proverbial scorched earth policy.
Yes.
They've so damaged, so degraded, and so destroyed and contaminated soil in Gaza that it will probably never grow crops again in anybody's yes. lifetime. And this is, by the way, a deliberate tactic of warfare, scorched earth. And
yes.
we're seeing that. And as you said, this is a really bad time in human history for us as a species to be tearing one another, to be tearing ourselves apart and tearing one another apart. We, you know, because we're facing larger existential threats, and we need, and maybe this might sound like wishful thinking, maybe it is wishful thinking, but this is the time that we need as a species to start thinking collectively about our own survival. Because we have this idea that we're, that, you know, nothing can overthrow us. I'm afraid that is a dangerous conceit, Eamon. We're facing into the remainder of the 21st century, where if we get a number of things wrong, and at the moment we're getting those things wrong,
yes.
Not very many humans will see the dawn of the 22nd century.
Yes, no, I understand that completely. And this is a problem that is for the younger generation. They're going to have to live with the consequences of inaction here, and inaction to the point of madness, really. I want to ask you about the responsibility. Green Party in government here, the Green Party in government in Scotland. But much of what we see is really tokenism. You know, the COP meetings where it's full of aspirational talk about what we're going to do. And then we come, and Ireland is probably not the worst culprit because it's a small nation, but we are certainly a culprit in terms of anything from SUVs, popularity, to the inability to build an infrastructure that would facilitate electric cars. This, at its worst, will make many countries in Africa, for example, uninhabitable. It will increase the migration and the effects of migration into Europe in probably a catastrophic manner, which we see a glimpse of now. Am I right in believing this is nothing compared to what's to come in terms of people needing to migrate from countries that have become uninhabitable because of the heat and the water, the absence of water?
Indeed, the equatorial regions, and this is right down through Africa and a belt that runs across South and Central America and a belt that runs across South Asia. These are highly vulnerable. These are already very close to their maximum temperature thresholds.
Yes.
And a nudge of another degree or two above that pre-industrial mark that I referred to earlier takes those large chunks of those areas from habitability into uninhabitability. Now, there was a big study done on this a couple of years ago in one of the science journals, and they talked about what they described as the human climate niche. And they basically said that as of 2019, I think it was, they said that about 0.8% of the Earth's surface, mostly, this is of the land surface, mostly in areas of within the Saharan Desert, are a mean temperature of about 29 degrees centigrade all year round. Now, that basically is too hot for humans or animals to survive in. So that's 0.8. They project that by 2070, which is a good deal less than 50 years out, that zone of uninhabitability will have spread from 0.8% to about 19% of the Earth's habitable surface. At the moment, Eamon, that 19% of the world's surface is where 3,000 million people live, right? So
yes.
We're looking here, I mean, to call this biblical would simply be an understatement. We're looking
yes.
at a massive migration, a forced migration like nothing that has ever been seen. And I think it's very important to stress as well that there's a massive climate justice component to this too. Remember, the folks in South America and Central America, the folks in many African countries, the folks across South Asia, by and large, have contributed almost nothing to this climate disaster. People like you and me
yes.
in wealthy parts of the country, high emissions. Bear in mind, every Irish man, woman, and child is responsible for the equivalent of between 12 and 13 tons of carbon dumped into the atmosphere in our name every single year, right? So we're massive contributors to this problem. Even though we're small in number, we make up for it by being large in impact. And what worries me and other people who look at this closely is that we are facing into an era of mass forced migration like we've never seen before. And also, unfortunately, that is likely, and we're already seeing that play out politically with the rise of extremism and far-right politics and populist leaders from Trump in America to Orban and many others, including the Italians. I suspect as climate migration increases and forced migration increases, we're going to see the failure and collapse of nation states, massive migration, an increase in warfare. You also mentioned, of course, water. Water is a key non-replaceable, like fresh water is a rare, valuable resource that is currently being squandered around the world. And we're likely to see, even where climate doesn't force people to migrate, the loss of access to fresh water will have exactly the same effect. And I suppose we're looking into a near future. I mean, if you think back to Italia 90, I'm sure you remember Italia 90. I certainly do. You do indeed. That's 30 years back, Eamon. But I mean, like, if you cast that distance forward, we're in the middle of the 2050s, right? So this is, these timescales are not as big as people think they are. I think that's important to bear in mind, because, you know, these are things that happened well within a chunk of our existence, of our current lives. And these are things that our children, our grandchildren are going to be plunged into. And I often, again, as a parent, as a journalist, I'm constantly asking myself, how can people be just sitting around and going, well, it's nothing to do with me. I live in Ireland. I don't care. And that is an attitude, Eamon. There was a study published by DOCUS, that charity, a couple of months ago. And what they found, you know, you read all these studies about how concerned Irish people are about climate change. I take them with a pinch of salt. This particular study by DOCUS research, what they found is that 14% of Irish people, in other words, 1 in 7, believe that they will personally be significantly impacted by climate change. That means that 6 in 7 people in Ireland don't understand climate change, right? No. And that, to me, strikes at the heart of it. I think we have an island mentality. We think because we've got this relatively temperate climate that this is going to happen to other people in other parts of the world and that it's going to pass us by. But we're a small, open, highly globalized economy, importing huge amounts of key resources. I've mentioned already foodstuffs. We cannot exist as an island apart. Apart from the forced climate migration, we completely depend for our well-being on existing relationships, trading relationships, economic relationships. And we cannot thrive. We can't get by even in a world of economic and political breakdown, social collapse, disorder, forced migration, and things like, for example, the European Union falling apart. And unfortunately, these are not fantastical notions. I mean, this is the trajectory that we're headed for. And if you think of it, Eamon, say, you know, by the end of this decade, right, we'll have put another 250 to 300 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. And people seem to have no idea that how close we are to the abyss. I mean, for example, if that triggers, a major release of permafrost in the Arctic tundra, if it releases methane clathrates, submarine methane clathrates, it's basically game over. I mean, that's how close we are. And yet to say that, because we never talk about this stuff on the radio, you don't hear debates on Morning Ireland about, you know, existential, like how close we are to actually, you know, doing ourselves out of existence. But here we are. And yet I follow the scientific press. I read the journals in this area, the published research, and it is absolutely crystal clear. It's often been said, Eamon, that the scientific consensus around climate change being real, dangerous, and human-caused is much stronger than the medical consensus linking tobacco with lung cancer. That's how crystal clear this stuff is.
Okay, John. We're very grateful to John Givens, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.